The recent hacks of Equifax and other large data breaches are cause for concern as we get into tax time. Taxpayers are being urged to file early if you can, particularly if your data has been compromised in any way, as there have been cases where thieves have used identity theft to collect your tax return before you even know it. Joining us live in our studios this morning is Brian Payne. He's the IRS Assistant Special Agent in Charge out of the Seattle field office. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So share with our listeners the mission of your office. You're with the criminal division, correct?
That's correct. So I'm with the criminal division, and our mission is to investigate potential violations of the Internal Revenue Code, as well as other financial investigations, in an effort to promote voluntary compliance with the Internal Revenue Laws.
And so tell us, what's the snapshot out here as far as identity theft, particularly with these data breaches that we just heard so much of, you know, last year?
Yeah, absolutely. In the state of Hawaii, you guys are actually relatively low when it comes to data breaches. In 2016, I believe there was only 31 cases reported. And in 2017, that increased up to 41 cases reported, which is relatively low when you compare that across the United States.
Okay, but you still have to be on guard.
Yes, absolutely. You know, identity theft and data breaches are a big issue for everybody, including the IRS. We're getting phone calls all the time asking for personal information. You're getting emails from individuals who are claiming to be your bank, and we need to be careful with that. And there are certain things that you can do to protect yourself against those data breaches and those ID theft individuals.
Now, the IRS just recently put something out about tax preparers that were being hit, that folks were getting in the back door that way.
Yes. Sometimes these thieves don't stop at just individuals. They go after the tax return preparers and try to get their specific identification number that then they can use to get into their return preparer software and file returns that are not accurate, that are false, and they can misdirect those refunds to their own individual bank accounts, and then they can use that money to live a lavish lifestyle or to spend it however they want to.
And so what other ways are people vulnerable to identity theft?
Well, I think the biggest issue is identifying what the different ways that these identity thieves are stealing your information. And they're doing it through your own personal identifying information, your Social Security number, your bank accounts, your date of birth, your address, your phone number. And so it's important for us as individuals and as taxpayers and citizens to protect that information. You know, if you're carrying around your Social Security number, you probably shouldn't be doing that. If you've got your Social Security number on documents that that you want to get rid of, that should probably be shredded and not put in the garbage. Same with bank statements. Anything that might have a bank account number on it or a credit card number, your name or your date of birth or a phone number, those should all be shredded and not just thrown away. Because the more information that you get out there, the more chances are you're going to be a victim of identity theft. And the last thing is that you should really be careful with all the different scams that are going on out there. With people making phone calls and claiming they're your bank or they're your credit agency, you need to understand it, or even claiming that they're the IRS. You know, you need to understand that, one, the IRS as an initial form of contact is not going to call you. They're not going to demand any money. They're not going to threaten you with arrest or whatever it might be. And the same goes with emails. That's not how we operate. That's not what we're going to do. So if you're receiving those type of information, those type of phone calls or emails, it's probably best that you get in touch with our Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration and report that type of activity so that they can do something about it.
Okay. And then I know there were a couple of cases here in Hawaii that have made the headlines where you've got trusted people that basically took your information and made money off of it.
Yes. We've had a couple of recent cases. One of them is an individual by the name of Richard Derrick. And what Mr. Derrick did is he stole identities of individuals who had passed away. And he focused on individuals who had names similar to his. And he would take those identities and he would file returns. He would get the refunds. And he didn't do this just with the Internal Revenue Service. He also did it with the state of Hawaii. And additionally, he took the identity of his deceased wife and filed false returns in her name. And he was recently sentenced to 24 months in prison for doing this scheme. He was able to steal almost $250,000 by perpetuating that identity theft scheme.
And the second one involved a tax preparer, right?
Yeah. Her name is Jennifer Sullivan, and she was just recently indicted. She actually she changed her name to Lihani Hani Sullivan. And she was a tax return preparer, and she stole the identities of a lot of her clients. And she used those identities to file false returns and gets false refunds. And what she would do is she would take those identities and in creating a false return, she would claim false expenses, false child care expenses, or inflate income or inflate the child earned income credit. And ultimately was able to get hundreds of thousands of dollars back in false refunds that then she used for her own personal gain. Additionally, she ran a charitable organization here locally that helped people, students with financial aid. And she would take the individuals that would come to help for her or ask her for help. She would take that information and she would use that fraudulently to obtain false income as well. And she used that for her own personal gain.
So scammers can come in different forms.
Absolutely.
And yeah. I know on the state side, they were doing what they could at the front end to double check that the money didn't just go out to someone, you know, who was bogus. What can you share with us as far as the IRS efforts to kind of filter out at the beginning to prevent people from becoming victims?
Yeah, the IRS, we've done a lot of work over the last several years to cut down on the amount of identity theft refunds that are going out and identify these false returns as they're coming in and before we process them. And in fact, over the last few years, from 2016 to 2017, the IRS has seen a 50% reduction in the number of ID theft-related refunds that were being issued. So we've put in a lot of new filters. We've done a lot of investigations. We've done a lot of work from our standpoint, which has really helped with that decrease.
Okay. And so if, let's say, you do become a victim, what's the best advice you can tell people? How do you deal with this?
Well, the best advice I can give somebody if they think that they are a victim of identity theft is to contact your local police department. Get in touch with them, either call them, go into their office, and have them file a police report. Once you get that police report with the details in it, then you can go onto the IRS.gov webpage, and there's a lot of detail in there of how to handle this. But basically what you're going to do is you're going to file what we call an identity theft affidavit, which you're going to provide the information there in that affidavit. You're going to attach the police report that you got from the police department, and you're going to send that into the IRS. Once we receive it and we verify it's authentic, then we will issue you an IP PIN number, which is your identification protection PIN number. You will then use that moving forward to file your personal income tax returns. And that way we can verify that, hey, this is the true and correct return that we should be processing, not the one from one of the identity thieves. And that helps protect you. So those are the things that I would recommend that you do. But from a personal standpoint, I'd also contact the local credit bureaus, your TransUnions, your Equifax, your Experience, and put on a fraud alert on your account so that they can be monitoring your credit activity, so that if they see any unusual spikes in credit applications, that they can contact you and let you know so you can determine whether that was a fraudulent attempt or if that was actually something that you did. Additionally, I would contact your banks and your financial institutions to let them know that you might have been a victim of identity theft so that they can monitor to ensure that there aren't bank accounts being set up in your name. So those are the things that I would do and I would recommend your listeners do.
Right. But the main thing is it's a hassle. So if you can prevent your ID from getting out there and being used fraudulently, that's the best defense.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Payne is the assistant special agent in charge of the Seattle field office. He oversees IRS criminal investigation operations in Hawaii, Oregon, Guam, and Saipan. Brian's background includes tax and money laundering crimes. And reminder, as of last week, you can file your taxes electronically. You can download forms online or pick them up at your local library or at the state tax office.
It's $10 Tuesday at HPR, and you can become a sustaining member today, and your tax-deductible gift of $10 a month will be matched by 808-SKATE. We have $1,350 to go on that matching gift. We'd like to thank new sustaining members, Vicky Toys of Pahoa and Sally Ishikawa of Honolulu, for their donations. You can make those donations online on our mobile app, or you can call us at 955-8821. And at 11:16 in the islands, you're tuned to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the secrets of a great teacher, but first, your quiz.
Next in the program, we'll hear about a local teacher who was honored with a national award. So today's backyard quiz seemed to be a good time to look back at another Hawaii teacher who's gained international renown. In the late 1930s, a science teacher in Pu'unene recruited a group of young swimmers. They formed the three-year swim club. The name came from the rigorous training involved and their commitment to a minimum of 3 years with the goal of making the Olympic team. With few resources and no access to a swimming pool, the aspiring athletes practiced laps against the current of irrigation ditches on the sugarcane plantations owned by Hawaii Commercial and Sugar Company. And it paid off. Several members of the three-year swim club on Maui went on to become some of the best swimmers Hawaii has ever seen, including Olympic gold medalists Bill Smith and Yoshi Oyakawa. For today's quiz, what was the name of the inspirational science teacher turned swim coach? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. We'll dive into the answer later in the program.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, celebrating Chinese New Year with artist Long Long performing Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, 4 p.m. Sunday, February 18th at the Blaisdell. More at hisymphony.org.
Ken Kang didn't set out to be a teacher, but when he got his first opportunity to interact with students, inspiring them and being inspired in turn, he knew he had found a lifelong career path. He's IA High School's technology coordinator and this year's Hawaii winner of the Milken Educator Award. Earlier this morning, he told us how he became an educator and what it means to him.
I was working, after I got my engineering degree, I was working for a little bit with an engineering firm. My former teacher actually called me from my alma mater and said, hey, you know, the DOE schools are moving toward trying to see if they can create advancements in technology and looking toward future, implementation. So he asked if I could just kind of help out during part-time. That was actually the start of everything. As I was working in engineering and I was working part-time at the school, you know, that was an aha moment for me. You know, they always use the word aha. And I realized, you know, I was getting so much more joy, so much more gratification and rewards by working with students, working with, you know, their minds and be able to help them, you know, decide on future goals, you know, whether it be engineering, whether it be medical field, whether it be, you know, any kind of science or math or, you know, English or social, just being able to interact with them, it gave me so much more benefits in my whole life that I enjoyed working with them. And in the year 2005, I had a discussion with my parents and I said, you know, I'm going to switch careers. And of course, everyone's saying, what? Switching from engineering to
yeah,
teaching?
Sure.
However, going into teaching, they respected it. And I went in, totally did a change of careers. And here I am now. It's like a roundabout way coming back and giving back to my alma mater for developing the person I am. And now I want to give it back to them, you know, my alma mater at Aia High School.
Well, you know, Ken, it strikes me as the kind of decision that people usually make later in life. You know, I'm going to pursue joy rather than make a bunch of money. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like an older guy's kind of decision to make. But I guess it sounds as if the feedback from students was a big factor in that.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a survey out right now that, you know, in several years from now, the job market for technology will be so unsaturated. You know, we need to develop these kids and their minds to be tech ready, you know, future ready. And currently right now, you know, we're having a difficult time because, you know, in the technology field, people rather just work in that field. versus being able to bring that, you know, that knowledge and that expertise into a teaching area, so then we can pass that knowledge to our kids. And that's one of the main benefits of my drive, that I want to, you know, give them relevant information so that they can find a job, find a career, you know, that's going to be future ready for them, you know, for their future.
What does it take to be future ready? It would seem to involve speaking entirely new languages, yeah?
You know, these kids, I have to give it to them. They're tech savvy already. However, you know, we need to, as teachers, we need to, you know, be cognizant of how to teach them to use that technology, how to, you know, form the technology, how to develop the technology. So I'm really grateful that I went through the engineering program, because I was taught the engineering design, you know, being able to problem solve, being able to find resolution, and then going back and then resolving again, looking at over again. And I believe if we can teach that skills to our kids, whether they go engineering, whether they go to any kind of career field, whether they go, you know, to just going straight to the workforce, you know, that's the kind of mentality that we need to teach them so that they can move forward in life and not just be, you know, just accepted in whatever they're going to go into, but have that passion and drive to know that they're guiding their own future, you know, their path by us helping them learn that way.
Well, Ken, when you made the transition to becoming a teacher, how important was the real-world experience that preceded it?
Oh, it's absolutely so important. You know, I totally believe that currently our generation now needs to move away from a traditional standpoint of a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't totally believe in a full technology classroom. I do believe in a blended environment where teachers are teaching, but also students are teaching as well. What I realized in one of my classes, you know, I had my students teach because I felt, my God, you know, there was this lesson that I couldn't get to them. But when I asked one of the higher level students, said, hey, you know what, maybe you can teach this lesson. And when they taught it in a way that was in a level that the students could understand. And that gave me an aha moment. I said, you know what, we're going to have to change our style of teaching as well, because obviously what we've been doing, it may not be working, because each individual student has their own way of learning, yeah? So that was a drive for me. Okay, I need to get that so that I can teach them to be future ready by knowing how they learn from their peers.
Yeah, because, I mean, you found out that one of your students could get that across better than you could in that
situation. Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, so that takes a certain amount of descending from that teaching pedestal, you know, and previous generations thought it was very important that you students be a little bit in awe of the teacher.
Absolutely, but we need to change that mentality. These kids, they're you know, we live in that instant generation, that snap generation, you know, that social generation. But we got to give them credit, because they're actually picking up on things more than we ever thought they could.
Well, that's you know, that can be tricky for the teacher, just staying ahead, yeah?
Yeah, no, it is a different mindset that we you know, I like to teach that to our teachers, actually. So I do professional development with our teachers in regards to technology. And I kind of give them the sense, like, hey, let the students teach you, because they're gonna teach you something different, and you're gonna be like, wow, you know, that's awesome. Because then I tell them too, you know, wouldn't it be a good day, you can rest and your students can teach the lesson?
Well, yeah, I mean, it would seem to pay off for everybody.
And absolutely.
One of the things that in your teaching, Ken, you do a lot of projects, right? You
yes.
So you have that whole thing of getting a tangible result. How important is that?
Oh, that's really important. And, you know, with my current administration now, we're actually going to move our schools to what's called an academies model. And majority of the academies model is based on the PBL, which is project-based learning.
Uh-huh.
So what you can think of is, well, when I look at project-based, I kind of think of it as a backward mapping, where you get that project or that goal, and you design a lesson or a curriculum to reach that goal. You know, so our students, when they look at that goal, it's like, okay, I'm going to create that product. And however, I do tell them, because of the engineering process, when you get that goal, when you get that tangible object, you know, it's not perfect yet. We need to revise. We need to reflect and make sure that it's working for, you know, the goals that we want it to work at. So I'm always teaching them, hey, you have to look back. You have to reflect. Is it what you thought it was going to be? And having that tangible object makes them see that, you know, versus just kind of theoretical thinking, correct? Yeah?
Yeah, because that, you know, abstract thinking, theoretical thinking, it sometimes seems as if it can only take you so far, right?
And, yes, yes.
And it also seems to only appeal to a certain type of intellect. You might not catch everybody if it's just facts and books. Has that been your experience?
Oh, absolutely. You know, so it's so funny because someone had asked me and I said, you know, I know in the high school level it is hard because, you know, at times we have 180 students or so. However, I said, you've got to keep in mind that each student is an individual. We can't think that one way of teaching is going to work for all of them. You know, we have to, you know, the pedagogy of being cognizant of differentiation, mm-hmm. you know, being able to teach in different styles. So, you know, it's really good because, you know, the Hawaii State of Department of Ed always provides, you know, professional development in regards to, you know, audio learning, visual learning, kinesthetic learning, you know. So it's awesome that we get these tools, you know, but the hardest part for teaching is how do we implement that to make sure we hit each and every individual student.
Well, it seems to be working for you, Ken.
I don't know. Like I said, when I switched from engineering to teaching, I loved it. And I think people need to enjoy going to waking up every morning and going to work. And my interaction with the kids, it's pretty amazing. In 2015, when I started the STEM course in our school, one of the first things I told my kids was, don't let funding be the restriction. And I told them, you know, that final project you're going to create, let it be $1 million. Let it cost $1 million, it will get you there. And it's amazing what these kids did. One of the students created a prosthetic arm. Another student created a hazard bike a bag. Another student, which I'm very proud of, she felt that, you know, the mammograms are so barbaric. She actually designed a cloth that's able to feel the density, you know, of the chest region and being able to, in a nicer, gentle way, be able to create a 3D hologram of, you know, the person's chest area. So, I mean, I'm blown away with what these kids, their imagination can go to. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Ken Kang is IA High School's technology coordinator and this year's Hawaii recipient of the Milken Educator Award. He's an IA High graduate himself, and you can learn about him on our Facebook page.
And Ken Kang's job would probably be a lot harder without access to the Internet. Governor Ige has just signed an executive order that requires all Internet service providers that do business with the state of Hawaii to adhere to net neutrality principles. You may remember that back in December, the Federal Communications Commission voted to repeal the so-called net neutrality rules. Since then, three states, New York, New Jersey, and Montana, have enacted some form of state-level net neutrality protections for Internet users in those states. Yesterday, Hawaii became the fourth. A broader effort was announced at the same time by several state legislators. Bert Lum is the host of Hawaii Public Radio's Bite Marks Cafe and the newly appointed strategy officer for the state of Hawaii's broadband initiative. He broke down the local implications for us.
There are some bills that do kind of weave in net neutrality principles into the bill. And there was one mentioned by Rep. Bilotti yesterday, which was HB 1995. And if you take a look at that bill, it does talk about net neutrality and upholding the principles of free and open access to the Internet. And I think, you know, it has some good language in there. From the position that I'm in right now with DBED is that it also talks about setting up a state-owned ISP. So there's some comments that I have submitted in terms of the resources required to actually do something like that.
So do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, I think I don't know if the state should get into the business of being an ISP. So that's kind of the position that I'm taking. And as far as, you know, the kind of resources that you need to actually set that up and run it in a way that will service the consumers, you know, that's a whole other story, right? So there's a lot of resources that will go along with if that were to move forward.
There has been a lot of talk, even under the previous administration, to modernize and really push government along when it comes to technological advances. And there are issues with the state tax department and that whole modernization project. Yeah, so that might be one question is, does the state have enough resources to do what it would like to do?
Well, the state procures services from a variety of different places, right? So there could be some element of the state using their own resources internally to get a job done, or they could hire somebody like a vendor externally to provide maybe a whole system that gets implemented. So it's kind of a combination of those two things. In the case of trying to set up an ISP, I mean, that's going to require resources, whether it's internal or externally purchased. You know, there's still going to be a combination of expertise as well as money to get that done.
So it sounds like we're kind of massaging different ideas to see what might help fix this.
Well, I think the main point, you know, in terms of HB 1995 is that it was really to set up kind of a task force to look at whether or not some of these ideas are even feasible. So I think the idea of net neutrality and applying some of those principles to the ISPs, you know, is something to explore.
And your sense of the legal battle, I guess, that has started over this? I think Hawaii has joined a couple other states in opposing what the administration has done.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I should get into, you know, legal positions, but the FCC has taken a stance to repeal net neutrality, but then there's also the FTC that's also potentially weighing in as being an agency that would protect, you know, consumer rights. So there is some, you know, there's some discussion about whether or not any ISPs that provide or repeal net neutrality and start to make paid prioritization a part of their offering, if that's something that would even pass through the FTC. But that's, you know, that's something that's going to be handled in the courts, and, you know, it's kind of beyond my pay grade.
Right. But obviously different attacks on how to find some solution to this dilemma, where you have states where, you know, they just think it's wrong that we should be doing more to protect net neutrality.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing. I mean, the states are pretty much you know, autonomous, and they can govern in a capacity that is independent of the federal government. I mean, the federal government does provide the overarching, I guess, laws, and in the case of the FCC repealing, you know, net neutrality, I think the states can still adopt the principles of net neutrality and implement it in a state's jurisdiction.
Right, and for listeners out there whose eyes might glaze over when they hear net neutrality, bring home why this issue is so important to them.
Well, you know, there's a lot of coverage of net neutrality now, and I think the main thing that is trying to be gotten across is the fact that when net neutrality was in place, the content providers, and this is anything that you could access on the web, whether it's streaming audio, streaming video, websites, blogs, what have you, they all are able to be accessed equally across the spectrum of whatever service that you get. So whether you've got cable modems at home or you've got a dedicated internet connection for your business, you know, whatever you're accessing is equally accessible. In the case of net neutrality or the repeal of net neutrality principles, what happens is that the ISP could selectively throttle or have you perhaps pay more, which is called paid prioritization, for any of that content. And that opens up a whole other can of worms as to whether or not you would be able to not only get access to content that you want to get access to, but does that put them in a position of now limiting sort of free speech, right? So if there's sites that they feel that it's competitive against their own content, and I'm talking about, you know, let's say the video streaming in terms of, you know, the content that the big ISPs might own versus independent content providers, and if they're now limiting that access, then that starts to enter into the question of, you know, are they allowing you know, free speech to be enabled across the internet?
Right, and that's why lots of eyes are on this because of that access to information.
Yes, that's right, and I think, you know, the general consumer out there who's enjoyed the benefit of jumping on and surfing the web and viewing, you know, and enjoying whatever content they want to, if the world becomes a world where net neutrality did not exist, then there could be the situation where you now have to pay certain kinds of prices if you want to go to certain websites. So, and that's not a world that I think fosters innovation and the ability for, you know, even the small content provider to potentially excel in an environment that could be, you know, basically throttled and controlled by some major corporations.
That was Bert Lum, new strategy officer for the State of Hawaii's Broadband Initiative. He's also the host of Hawaii Public Radio's Tech Talk show, Bite Marks Cafe. You can hear Bite Marks Cafe in this program at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Demand for the city and county of Honolulu's handy van service is the highest per capita in the nation, and its cost to riders among the lowest. That $2 cost has stayed the same for 17 years, but the city is running into heated opposition to its efforts to raise fares. Reporter Marcel Honore has the story in today's Reality Check from Honolulu Civil Beat. Good morning, Marcel.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
This is a tough situation made tougher by the fact that an awful lot of the riders are on fixed incomes, yeah?
Yeah, you know, it's a real dilemma. You talk to city officials, and they'll say, you know, a lot of riders are not on fixed income. Like, they'll say that the majority are actually not on these really extremely limited budgets. However, there's probably about 9 or 10% of the ridership, which represents about 500 people. Even by the city's own estimates, that would be affected by increasing fares.
Well, in your piece, you've got the numbers on one frequent user who is already, you know, stretching her limited income to the limit, a couple hundred bucks a month.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when you're on Social Security, you know, and you're relying on food stamps and everything, even, you know, a dollar increase. So the city hasn't raised this fare in 17 years. But right. On the flip side, when you're on such an extremely limited budget, you almost live or die on you know, these kind of increases. And even a 25-cent increase, you know, that's $30-$40 if you're using this service every month. $30 or $40 a month, I should say. You know, if you're relying on it so heavily.
Has the city given any indication of how much of an increase it would like to make?
Yeah, so the city's Department of Transportation Services is actually looking to double the fare by July 2019. So what they would do is currently it's $2, and they look to increase it by $1 to $3 this October, and then take another step up to $4 in 2019. Now, that's just DTS's proposal. There's a new rate commission, which is an advisory group that was set up last year, and they've just started to take a look at this. They're looking to make a recommendation on what to do that may or may not coincide with what DTS wants to do, and they're looking to do that ahead of the budget talks later this year.
But it certainly sounds as if it's going to go up and up pretty substantially, no matter who does it, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's the way this is heading is it is going to be a strain on some of the most vulnerable users that rely on the handy van.
Well, thanks, Marcel. We'll want to keep in touch with this story. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
That was reporter Marcel Honore with today's Reality Check from Honolulu Civil Beat.
State lawmakers are to hear a bill today that appropriates money to study sewage in our nearshore waters. Hawaii has some 90,000 cesspools across the state. Kahului on Oahu and Maui are some areas of particular concern. The state health department is pushing for these cesspools to get converted because of the possible threat to our drinking water and our marine environment. but progress is slow, even though there are tax credit programs in place. We've been sitting down with the head of the city's wastewater program. Lori Kaikina is Honolulu's chief engineer. The city just can't quickly shift gears and add capacity because it's under a federal order to upgrade its sewage treatment plants. That includes a set schedule for fixes and hikes in wastewater fees. So diverting from that is complicated because the city would have to ask up for a break from the courts and the parties involved.
The consent decree is an agreement with EPA, DOH, and the NGOs. So all would have to buy into it. But you're absolutely right. I continue to state the same thing. I went to the legislature when DOH was presenting their report, that our consent decree is our priority. And if they somehow want us to get involved with Kahalu, is probably the best situated area to sewer, because I'm saying relatively close by. The sewer, existing city sewer system is relatively close by. But we would need some kind of a relief on the consent decree to move it up in priority. When we had our last annual meeting with EPA and Department of Health, I mentioned that maybe a solution would be blending. And what that means is, so at Sand Island, we treat maybe to 60 to 70 million gallons per day. When it rains, that rain is somehow getting into our sewer system, and it jumps up to about 250 million gallons. So we have to treat, when we go to full secondary in 2035, we have to treat all of that. And I want to say 90% of that is rainwater. Why make us upgrade and spend billions of dollars to go all the way to that maximum peak flow? During the storm, I'm asking to blend. Let that rainwater and sewage that's been combined go through just primary and then go out to the outfall. And it's not unheard of. We're in Region 9. Region 10 already allows this. So I was asking, instead of having to build secondary all up to, let's say, 250 million gallons, let us go maybe 100, 150. So that will save us millions of dollars, and then maybe we can refocus that funds to sewering other areas.
Okay, but the ask is kind of complicated because it's tied up in the consent decree.
We would have to go to the courts, and then EPA, Department of Health, and the NGOs would have to be present and agree to this.
Lots of challenges in your department.
Yes.
The picture is a little unbalanced between what it costs to collect our garbage, what it costs to burn our garbage or landfill items, and then dealing with the very important wastewater issue.
Correct.
Now, I know there's a set schedule for fee hikes to deal with some of this. What's the snapshot going forward?
We are anticipating some kind of a fee increase. We're still running our model to see when we can, how we can squeeze that in. We do need to get it past administration approval and, of course, city council approval. But we're looking at another six-year rate increase, but I don't have the numbers yet.
Okay, starting next year?
Maybe next year, yeah. But we're still running the model. I have to still get, haven't presented it to administration yet.
Right. But when we did have the consent decree, there was a schedule, and that ran for, was it 6 years? The first 6 years?
At the time we were negotiating the consent decree, yes, it was 6 years, and it stopped. And I want to say the last increase, it was a big one. I want to say like 8% a couple of years ago. So we did not increase 1 year.
Okay. Are you slated to increase this year or no?
If I could get approval, and if we're, like I said, we're trying to run the model right now.
Gotcha.
And
so you just don't know how much you might ask for.
I just don't know.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. Well, we can couch it like that then. All right. Anything else you want to underscore? Like I said, kind of challenging times for environmental services.
Yes.
And everybody's just everybody's pocketbook is a little weird.
Absolutely. We're so conscious of that. And so I guess that's the main thing. I was harping with the state. I really had the fear they were going to dump the cesspool program on us because it's a state-run program. And I was just so afraid they were going to do that. But they didn't. And when we met with the legislatures there, you know, my testimony was we should be part of the solution. I mean, you can't just, even the homeowners, for them to convert, you're talking $10,000, $20,000. Even if the city comes in, our main responsibility is the infrastructure up to the home. Right. They still have to do the the conversion on their property. So that's a lot of money. And, you know, Tim, my deputy, he's the money person. He's always conscious of, well, the existing ratepayers, should they front all of that? You know, that's not really fair either.
Right, and that's what we were hearing, is that there might be some legislation that would charge a fee for all users to help with the cesspool issue.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Yeah, that's what we heard from one lawmaker. But anyway,
oh gosh, we'll see. So that wouldn't be fair. So the existing ratepayers who have been paying sewer fees all these years, and the cesspool people have not been paying at all. That's not fair for the existing people to pay to front to put up the sewer system for these people who haven't been paying all these years.
And that was Lori Kaikina, the director of Honolulu's Department of Environmental Services, talking about some very complex issues on how to best deal with an aging sewer system and the need to protect the environment.
We asked you in our backyard quiz to name the Maui science teacher turned swim coach who founded the 3-year swim club. In 1937, Soichi Sakamoto set his sights on the 1940 Olympics and pledged to recruit and train a group of young swimmers to compete at an international level. With the motto Olympic first, Olympic always, it was clear the club had high aspirations. Sakamoto used interval training and a weight pulley system to strengthen and condition his athletes. And with the onset of the Second World War, both the 1940 and 1944 Olympics were canceled. Sakamoto's dreams were put on hold. In 1948, 11 years after its creation, the 3-year swim club had success. Club member Bill Smith made that Olympic swim team. Smith brought home the gold in the 400 freestyle and 800 freestyle relay, and Sakamoto finally had his first Olympic champion. Sakamoto was asked to serve as assistant coach for the U.S. Olympic swim team from 1952 to 1956, and during those years, proudly coached 9 of his swimmers from Hawaii.
And we are pleased to report that Grant Merrill had the fastest fingers. He was the winner of our today's backyard quiz. He was also one of Coach Sakamoto's swimmers. We had lots of people call in, many of his swimmers, and we thank you all for trying. But that is today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's new Career Center, helping students to explore careers, understand education requirements, and get localized data on salary and jobs. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
The transition into college life is rarely an easy one, and for many students who are away from home for the first time, life outside the classroom can pose challenges of its own. A pilot program at UH Manoa aims to ease that transition by drawing on a cherished Hawaii tradition. The Hanai Family Project pairs students coming to the university from the U.S. mainland or off-island with volunteer faculty or staff members. More than 80 students took part this year, and UH is looking to expand the program. Deborah Halpert, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at UH Manoa, told us how it came about.
Last year, we were going through our strategic planning process, and one of the faculty at one of the open meetings that we had suggested a program like this. Mm-hmm. And it had been something that we talked about in the meetings as well. And the concept of Hanai, of course, is very much part of, I think, the ethic of Hawaii. And so we used that as the foundation for the program that we built.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, What does it seek to address, I guess, would be the question.
So what we were trying to do was create informal connections for students. And our first pilot, this isn't a pilot phase, I should say. Our first pilot group were students that came from off-island. So either they were coming from one of the other islands in Hawaii or they were coming from the U.S. mainland. And so the goal was to provide them with a connection here. Oftentimes they feel disconnected. They're far from home, possibly for the first time. And so we really wanted to provide a way for them to connect with someone that wasn't an institutional official.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about finding families?
So what we did, again, in the pilot year is we sent out an invitation to all the faculty and staff at the university, and we were just asking for volunteers. And we got about 90 of those, which was a really nice group for our first pilot. And then we also sent out to all of the accepted students that were from off-island an invitation to join the program. So purely voluntary at this point, and then we tried to match them fairly loosely across lines of interest. So we weren't trying to put them into their major category. We were really looking more at activities that they like to do or things they like to read, those kinds of things.
So there's some sort of, there are some match-up parameters.
We tried. And again, we'll work based on the feedback we get this year to see how we should do it in the future.
How's the feedback coming so far?
So far, I think it's been pretty positive. I think the big struggle is that everyone's so busy, it's been a challenge for some folks to meet up with their students or vice versa. So we try to encourage everyone to meet about once a month throughout the academic year. And again, just meet for coffee or perhaps invite your student to go to an event. I have a student, I take him rock climbing because that's something I like to do and it's something he likes to do. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to meet up to do that.
So does it have to be a family, a couple with kids, or
we,
a single person?
We opened it up to whoever was interested in volunteering. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be a family. But what we've seen is that whoever is the volunteer from the university has incorporated their family into the event.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes roommates get involved, too, so or friends of your Hanai student.
Well, that's one of the things in those early years in college. It's quite a, you know, it's quite a switch from your previous life, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And that's one of the things we wanted to try to address is provide a little bit of a buffer zone for that big switch.
What kind of feedback had you been getting from students that sort of moved you toward this idea?
Well, a lot of our concern is that students, especially in that first year, feel lonely, they feel homesick. And oftentimes that means they don't want to stay at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Instead, they want to return to be closer to home. And so we were really trying to address those issues of disconnection and loneliness. And as we go forward, I think we would like to expand this program out, assuming we can get sufficient volunteers, to students from Hawaii and Oahu specifically as well, and really look at students that may be experiencing college and not have backgrounds in their family of college attendance. So they'll need maybe a little bit more help making that transition.
Do students from neighbor islands feel that kind of disconnect?
I think so. Again, our surveys don't necessarily always distinguish where somebody's from when we ask those questions, mm-hmm. but we definitely have students who decide not to return that are from the outer islands.
I'm just wondering, by comparison with students mm-hmm. on the mainland, what kind of feedback you would get.
Mm-hmm. In this program, I don't know yet because we haven't asked our final questions. We'll do that towards the end of this semester. But overall, I think one of the things that we see from our student population, especially in the first year, is a feeling of disconnection from the university as a reason for their not returning, mm-hmm. along with financial concerns and a variety of other issues as well.
Because you do survey reasons for not returning.
We do. In fact, we just completed what's called a leaver study to try to find out why students didn't return.
Yeah.
Really, one of the more important reasons is financial. Which isn't really what our program can address. So we're truly trying to make this a more hospitable environment for our first-year students through this program.
What will it take, what would it take to expand the program?
Well, yesterday I had a meeting with our alumni liaisons, and they are going to be asking some of our alumni if they would like to volunteer to be Hanai students. And mm-hmm. so really, to expand the program, we would need more volunteers to help support students. And ideally, what we would do next at the student level is instead of asking for student volunteers, to really give students their HANAI contact upon admission. But that's maybe a couple years in the future.
You mean have students actually be students or maybe a couple of years ahead? Be the ones to sort of guide your transition into college life?
Yeah, we've got a couple. We could use students. Obviously, if faculty and staff want to be involved, we would love for that to happen. And then the alumni who may have just graduated or a few years out, mm-hmm. that can still give them insights into what college is like. We'd like to use that population as well. But more to the point, one of the things we did learn this year is that the students who volunteered for our program were oftentimes perhaps not the ones that we would most need a program like this. So, for example, they were already the ones that were joining everything and excited about coming to the university and were able to make that transition. Whereas some of the students who didn't join the program, because, again, it was voluntary, may be the ones we really wanted to get at. So
sure.
For our next few pilots, we need to figure out how we get at that population of
Not
students.
Not everybody is a joiner
Not
by nature.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the ones who aren't are the ones who probably could benefit the most.
Right. But are also the more resilient ones that are probably going to figure out how to adapt and survive in Hawaii on their own anyway.
Yeah.
And so it's really getting to the ones that are feeling a little more homesick, that are maybe shyer, and aren't likely to affirmatively go out and join something. So those are some of the challenges we have going forward with our program.
You know, one would think, and I would guess that a lot of students are surprised because they, you know, the whole idea of going to college, particularly for mainland students, college in Hawaii, visions of paradise. And I wonder if they express some surprise at finding out that there are just as many challenges as going to any other university.
I think they do. I've learned a lot from this program, from getting to talk with my HANAI student, because he lives in the dorms, and so I'm getting a lot of firsthand knowledge about what the dorms are like these days, from as opposed to my own experience 30 years ago. And so it's been really interesting to see how he's addressed the issues that are part of dorm life. And again, my student has been very excited about being here, has joined everything. He's doing fine.
Deborah Halpert is the Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at UH Manoa and the coordinator of the HANAI Family Project.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, announcing a science symposium for girls in grades 5 to 8, Saturday, February 17th. Registration at sacredhearts.org/symposium.
And that's it for today, and up tomorrow we'll be talking about STEM education for girls.
And tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us a comment. That number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want to pass one, you can find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.